welcome to Sojourner Truth. Thank you for staying with us. This is your host, Margaret Prescott. Today on Sojourner Truth, Bernie Sanders wowed the nation in a controversial town hall showed on Fox News, and he is ahead in fundraising as well as in the polls. Nevertheless, the establishment of the Democratic Party are seemingly in denial about Bernie being the front runner in the early race for president. The establishment in the Democratic Party seemed to be hoping for a more centrist candidate, reflecting what is seen to be a rift in the party between progressive and centrist members of Congress. Does Bernie stand a chance against the Democratic political establishment? What's going on? We speak to Diane May, who is with the Bernie campaign, and also with Norman Solomon, journalist, media critic, author, and activist. And for our Campaigners for Black Lives series, Dr. Melina Abdullah joins us to discuss a controversial bill in the California Assembly that would limit when police officers can fire their weapons. Also, there are hundreds of political prisoners in the United States who've been incarcerated for decades, including Dr. Mulatu Shakur, the father of Tupac Shakur. Back with us is Peter Shea, Executive Director of the Center for Human Rights and Constitutional Law. Also, our weekly Earth Minute is back. We live in a global world. We're all interrelated. So on Sojourner Truth, we work to bring directly to you news and views on local, national, and international policies and stories that affect us all. And we draw out how those of us most impacted, women, communities of color, and other communities are responding. We also discuss the interrelationship between art and politics. Now for our news headlines.
For Pacifica Radio, I'm Eileen Alfandari. President Trump vetoed a resolution passed by Congress to end U.S. military assistance to Saudi Arabia for its war in Yemen. Trump's veto message called the resolution an unnecessary and dangerous attempt to weaken his constitutional authorities. He claimed it would endanger the lives of U.S. citizens and service members both today and in the future. The U.S. provides billions of dollars of weapons to the Saudi-led coalition fighting against rebels in Yemen. Saudi airstrikes have killed civilians at weddings, hospitals, schools, and markets. The fighting and blockade of ports has left the impoverished nation suffering from food, medical, and water shortages, caused a cholera outbreak, and has pushed Yemen to the brink of famine. Vermont Senator and presidential candidate Bernie Sanders co-authored the War Powers Act resolution. He said he was disappointed by the veto and that he and colleagues would continue their efforts to reassert congressional responsibility over war-making and end U.S. involvement in unauthorized and unconstitutional wars. Silicon Valley Democrat Ro Khanna, who led the effort in the House, said Trump is risking the lives of millions of Yemeni civilians to famine, deadly airstrikes, and war crimes of the Saudi regime. He called for a veto override. Both the votes in the House and Senate were short of the two-thirds needed to override a presidential veto. Attorney General William Barr has announced the latest Trump administration move against immigrants seeking asylum. Barr has decided that detained asylum seekers who have shown they have a legitimate fear of being forced to return to their country will no longer be able to ask an immigration judge to grant them release from detention on bond. Under the new ruling, they'll have to wait in detention until their case is adjudicated, a process that could take months or even years. The decision does not affect asylum-seeking families. They generally cannot be held for longer than 20 days. It also does not apply to unaccompanied minors. Denver area public schools are closed today as authorities search for a young Florida woman who flew to the city and bought a gun after reportedly becoming infatuated with the mass shooting at Columbine High School. Saturday marks the 20th anniversary of the shooting by two teens, which killed 12 classmates and a teacher. The FBI said 18-year-old Sol Pais traveled to Colorado from Miami on Monday night and legally bought a pump-action shotgun and ammunition. The FBI said she's considered to be extremely dangerous and made threats to commit an act of violence in the Denver metropolitan area. Dean Phillips is the FBI agent in charge.
We have no specific information about any specific threat to any particular school. We don't have that sort of credible information, but we do consider her to be a credible threat to the community.
Authorities said Pice was last seen near Columbine wearing a black T-shirt, camouflage pants, and black boots. On day three of disruptive climate change protests in London, activists kept control of four key sites: Marble Arch, Waterloo Bridge, Parliament Square, and Oxford Circus. London police said their arrest total in the first 2 days of protests is 290. Extinction Rebellion is demanding the British government tell the truth about climate change and declare a climate emergency leading to zero carbon emissions by the year 2025. The group was founded in Britain but has gone global. The Guardian said organizers reported demonstrations had taken place or were planned in 80 cities across 33 countries. A French bishop says he will close Notre Dame Cathedral for 5 to 6 years. Bishop Patrick Chauvet said a segment of the cathedral was very weakened by Monday's devastating fire, which torched the roof and brought down the spire. French President Macron told the country he wants the entire cathedral restored in 5 years. Parisians continue to gather at the site of the cathedral and mourn.
I felt deeply sad. I think it's a part of our heritage. It really breaks my heart to see that it has gone up in smoke.
I'm a Catholic girl, so it was very hard to see because as a French girl, I'm used to go to Notre Dame. I was very, very sad and I cried because it's the church of my childhood.
My name is Patrick. I grew up here. I've been seeing this cathedral my whole life. Of course, it's devastating to see it burn.
Nearly $1 billion already has poured in from ordinary worshipers and high-powered magnates from France and around the world to restore Notre Dame. I'm Eileen Alfandari. You're listening to Sojourner Truth on Pacifica Radio.
And this is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. And we're going to start out today's show with our segment, our ongoing series, Campaigners for Black Lives. And the eyes of the nation are on California right now. Why? AB 392, a bill in the California Assembly that would raise the standard under which law enforcement can discharge their guns, passed out of the Assembly Committee in Sacramento, the Assembly Committee on Public Safety, on April 9th. Testimony from family members who had loved ones killed by police officers, as well as community activists, were heard in support of AB 392. The bill was introduced by Assemblymember Shirley Weber, Democrat of San Diego. Those in opposition include the California Fraternal Order of Police, who claim the bill would put them in more danger. The California State Sheriff's Association also opposed the bill. However, although it passed out of assembly in a 5-2 vote, out of the Assembly Committee of Public Safety in a 5-2 vote, passage of the legislation is not ensured. A bill said to be a compromise has been proposed in the Senate, and rather than the Assembly bill heading to a vote in the Assembly, it has been moved to the Assembly Rules Committee. It is seen as an effort to block or water down the bill. On the Senate side, law enforcement organizations are supporting a bill, Senate Bill 230, which would simply require that a policy that provides use of force guidelines and stresses training, that the use of force guidelines and underscoring training be put in place. Law enforcement agencies are seeing SB 230 as an alternative to the bill that passed out of the Assembly Committee on Public Safety, that is AB 392. Now, with police shootings on the rise across the nation and Black and brown communities who are most impacted seeing very little, if any, justice, the eyes of the nation are on California to see how this controversial bill, AB 392, will play out. Let us go to a clip now on AB 392.
I'm here to present to you AB 392, the California Act to Save Lives. This bill seeks to change California's legal standard for when police can use deadly force to match best practices already in place at some departments, and that we know work to keep both officers and the public safe. In 2017, officers killed 172 people in California. Most of those were unarmed. Of the 15 police departments with the highest per capita rates of police killings in the nation, five of them are in California. Bakersfield, Stockton, Long Beach, Santa Ana, and San Bernardino. In 2015, police in Kern County killed more people per capita than any other U.S. county. Current law results in officers killing civilians far more often than is necessary, leaving many families and communities devastated and the general public less safe. These tragedies disproportionately impact communities of color. Studies show police killed unarmed young Black men at more than 20 times the rate they kill young white men. This has understandably created a rift between police and community members to the detriment of public safety. The power of police officers to use deadly force is perhaps the most significant responsibility we confer on any public official, and it must be guided by the goal of safeguarding human life. Police officers should never take a human life when there are alternatives. However, current law sanctions police use of deadly force even when officers do not face an imminent threat to their life or bodily security, and even when officers have reasonable alternatives at their disposal to safely address a situation without taking anyone's life. California's existing law governing when a homicide by an officer is justified was written in 1872. This code, being the single oldest unamended use of force statute in the country, not only fails to include best practices, but authorizes deadly force that violates the U.S. Constitution.
Officers should be held accountable.
At the state capitol, the energy overflowing, spilling over into the hallway for Assembly Bill 392.
Stockton actually had one of the highest rates of a police-involved shootings in the nation,
which would revolutionize police use of deadly force.
We can't continue to have a bill and a law from 1872.
A passionate turnout.
They knew my son had mental illness. This kid didn't have a police record. He didn't even have a speeding ticket.
Rooted in deep pain.
You may have heard of the movie Fruitvale Station, but that's my life. My son was killed there.
From mother.
Please pass this bill so that they may be prosecuted for killing my baby.
After mother.
And after they killed my son, they gave each other a high five.
After mother.
My son is Nathaniel Harris Pickett. He was gunned down by San Bernardino County Sheriffs. I'm a retired U.S. Army colonel, two-time combat vet at the Pentagon on the day it was hit.
Okay, so there you have it. And I'd like to welcome back to Sojourner Truth our guest, Dr. Melina Abdullah. Melina, welcome.
Thank you so much, Margaret.
Dr. Melina Abdullah, professor, author, and community organizer in Los Angeles. She is an original member of Black Lives Matter and now serves on the leadership team for Black Lives Matter. She is committed to ending state-sponsored and police violence towards all people, and especially Black people. She is professor and chair of Pan-African Studies Department at Cal State University, Los Angeles, and she's also the immediate past campus president and current counsel for affirmative action chair for the California Faculty Association, which is the union for faculty. So, Melina, tell us about both the importance of this bill, but in the lead up to the introduction of the bill, the kind of mobilization that Black Lives Matter, but also a score of other community-based organizations across the state have had to do.
Sure. So most people know that Black Lives Matter, our primary work is not legislative work. In fact, we've only co-sponsored one other bill. This is the second bill that we're co-sponsoring. The reason that we're co-sponsoring the bill is because it's a meaningful bill that really will help to kind of rein in the the way in which our community is abused and killed by police. So it does three things. It changes the use of force standard, so it moves it from what they call the reasonable officer standard. Listeners will know that most officers get off because they say, I feared for my life, and that's all they have to say. And then they're kind of off the hook. So it eliminates that excuse. It requires a de-escalation, the employment of de-escalation tactics. And then it holds officers who kill our people outside of these standards criminally liable. So there will be real repercussions for police. And one of the other things that we do that's more in line with Black Lives Matter is we protest the district attorney every single week because she refuses to prosecute the police. She's been able to use the excuse, oh, well, the standards are too high, and so I'm not able to prosecute them. When this bill goes into effect, no district attorney in the state will be able to say that they're unable to prosecute the police who kill our folks.
Right. And Black Lives Matter LA and in other parts of the state clearly were part of a number of organizations that worked to support this bill, but also to get it introduced. Who are some of the other supporters of this legislation and who are the ones who are opposing it?
So we're really appreciative of Shirley Weber, the bill's author who comes out of San Diego. She's the former chair of Africana Studies at San Diego State. So Dr. Weber really has an eye on, you know, how do we protect especially Black communities? But as we know, what happens to Black communities visits other communities, especially brown folks, Muslim folks, immigrant folks, and poor folks. And so she is the bill's author, and she's been working in close partnership with us, with Policy Link, with the ACLU, Youth Justice Coalition, my labor union, the California Faculty Association, the Anti-Police Terror Project, PICO, which is an organization of spiritual leaders who recognize that the spiritual work that they do, the religious work that they do, has to be tied to justice work. So a host of organizations are co-sponsoring the bill. And then organizations that are not co-sponsors are also signing on quickly to support White People for Black Lives, showing up for racial justice. The NAACP is looking to get involved. Even organizations that we don't normally work with understand that this is something that's hugely important. I think most important, though, is that this is driven by those who are most directly impacted by police killings. So the clip that you played showing the mothers or where the voices of the mothers are centered is really, really important. Last week when we went up and got this passed, so we had buses coming up from Los Angeles, over 300 folks showed up in Sacramento on April 9th and advocated for this bill. And those buses were filled with not only community organizers, but most importantly, the families of those who've been killed by police, who are saying, you know, in order for my child, in order for my sister, in order for my parents' life to mean something, something has to come out of their murder. And they really believe that by passing this bill, they'll be able to save lives and honor the their loved ones by doing this work. So it's passed through committee, which is a tremendous first step. Every Democrat on that committee voted in favor of this bill. But we also know that Republicans especially, but also some Democrats, listen too much to police, right? And so they are swayable. And as the bill passes through committee, we also need to start letting our elected officials know, letting our legislators know that we need them to support it as it goes to the full floor for a vote. And so we're asking everybody to get involved at this point and make sure that they call their legislator and say that they support AB 392 because the police have mobilized. They have given money to elected officials to say, do not pass this bill. They're afraid of this bill because they don't want to be held accountable. So we need everybody to call their legislator and say, you know, don't listen to the police lobby's money. Listen to the voice of the people who elected you. And so if you don't know who your legislator is, You can call this number, 855-644-2258, and it will connect you with your legislator. And we just need you to say, hey, I'm a voter, and we need you to pass AB 392 so that our people can live and not continue to be killed by police with impunity.
Could you repeat that number, Melina?
Sure. It's 855-644-2258. 855-644-2258. And that's the number to be connected to your assembly member so that you can ask them to support AB 392.
Right. Well, Melina Abdullah, thank you again for joining us, for breaking this down for us. And also, Melina, you and Black Lives Matter, you partner with us for our weekly Campaigners for Black Lives. And we do know for our listeners around the country, people are paying very close attention to this because we know that police shootings of Black and brown people, not only a California phenomenon, but a national one with very little justice. So Dr. Melina Abdullah, thank you so much.
Margaret, can I say just one more thing really quickly?
Okay.
We have to block that Senate Bill 230, which is the police's bill that's trying to get more money for police. Training always means more money for police.
Yeah.
And it's really lying about what it's trying to do. So a group of us are going up to Sacramento next Tuesday. If any of your listeners want to join the bus ride, it's completely free. There's food, and it's a lot of fun to really kind of be in community with
yeah.
folks who believe in justice. So if they're interested, please email us at Black Lives Matter. It's email blmla@gmail.com.
Right.
Email blmla@gmail.com if you want to get on the bus next Monday night to be up there. Tuesday, we'll be back by Tuesday night.
Okay, and if you send us that information as well, we'll post it on our social media so our listeners can access it. Thank you so much,
Melina. Thank you so much. All right.
All righty. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. Now, a little known fact that there are hundreds of prisoners across the United States who are being kept in prison, a number of them political prisoners, and without the possibility of parole, although a number of them are aging at this moment. They include Dr. Mutulu Shakur, who is a Black activist whose primary work was in the area of health. He's the stepfather to the late rap artist Tupac Shakur. He is a doctor of acupuncture and co-founder and director of two institutions devoted to improving healthcare in the Black community. In his youth, he was active with the Revolutionary Action Movement known as RAM and later the Republic of New Africa. And while a member of the Black Liberation Army, he was sentenced to 60 years in prison for their claiming his involvement in the 1981 robbery of a Brinks armored truck in which a guard and two police officers were killed. But at no time did any evidence was produced to show that Dr. Shakur killed anyone. But he's not the only one in prison, and perhaps wrongfully. They include Leonard Peltier, activist with the American Indian Movement, who got caught up in a COINTELPRO-style operation. He is still in prison and for a crime that he didn't commit. Of course, you have Mumia Abu-Jamal, one of the most prominent political prisoners in the United States. Again, in 1981, a COINTELPRO-style operation. He was arrested and first sentenced to death. Now, a whole national and international movement have gotten him off of death row and into general population, but he's still in prison, and he's a distinguished journalist still until today. Others include Ramsey Munez, Chicano activist, Sandiato Akoli, who was with Asata Shakur, Russell Maroon Schultz, another dedicated community activist, former member of the Black Panther Party, Jalil Matakim, a former member of the Black Panther Party and the Black Liberation Army, and Alfred Woodfox. We're happy to say that he was just released. He was a prisoner that spent the longest time that we know of in U.S. history in solitary confinement. He was in solitary confinement for 43 years. He was released in February 2016. So there's there are a lot more that we could speak about, but a lot of people don't know that Peter Shea, who is the executive director for the Center of Human Rights and Constitutional Law that we generally have on the air, talking about the rights of migrant children in particular, that he has also been involved with the situation of these prisoners. So welcome back, Peter Shea.
Thank you very much for having me.
Okay. So, Peter Shea, what is the situation that you are concerned about? Just sum it up for us with these prisoners and about how many are there approximately?
Okay. I'll do my best. It's a complicated situation. There are about 450 prisoners that currently in the Bureau of Prisons system that we're concerned with and are engaging in litigation on behalf of. One has to go back several years to understand the current situation. The Parole Commission was set up, I think, about 1976, and Congress found that the release of prisoners was being handled in a what Congress said was a inequitable and capricious and uniquely arbitrary corner of the criminal justice map. So Congress set up this commission, which initially had about 16 members, and it had two levels. So you'd first have a regional group of commissioners decide a case, and then you could appeal that to a national appeals board if you were denied parole. Now, Congress understood that there were certain prisoners who were long-term prisoners, and so it created really two steps for parole, or two different approaches to parole. One was a normal approach in which there could be wide range of issues could be considered, including the seriousness of the crime, how long the prisoner has spent, the prisoner's rehabilitation, etc. But Congress also created an exception or a second route, which the author, I think was Senator Kerstenmeyer, specifically said was intended to be a more liberal approach to release for long-term prisoners. And these were for people who spent about 30 years in prison. And those people were to be, were rather than having to prove their eligibility for parole, the burden was really on the parole. It switched the burden of proof to the Parole Commission to establish that they should not be released. And it created a fairly simple test. It's called mandatory parole. And it said, prisoners shall be released unless they have frequently and seriously violated the prison rules. So you have that exception to the general parole provisions. What we have found is that, number one, the Parole Commission was then subsequently abolished entirely by Congress because it found that it wasn't really working fairly. So in 1984, Congress passed the Sentencing Reform Act, and it abolished the commission. However, it kept the commission in place to continue to have jurisdiction over crimes that were committed prior to that period, about 1984. So old-time prisoners would still be subject to the U.S. Parole Commission. And at that time, there were tens of thousands of prisoners subject to the Parole Commission because their crimes were committed prior to that time. However, over the years, obviously, those prisoners have slowly been released or completed their sentences. So today, there are only about 450 prisoners left, and it includes all these political prisoners, Leonard Peltier and Rosa Bowers, Matulu Shakur, and others. There are only 450 prisoners left in the Bureau of Prisons, who are still subject to the jurisdiction of the Parole Commission. And what we have determined is that for those prisoners, the actions of the parole commission have been arbitrary, we believe, illegal, and in violation of the federal statutes. So that's what we are currently trying to challenge in the federal court.
If you succeed, what would that mean in practice?
What that would mean in practice is three or four things. Number one, it would mean that these prisoners would be entitled to, not to immediate release, but would be entitled to new parole hearings, hopefully properly new parole hearings under proper standards. And what do I mean by that? What do we mean by that? Number one, the statute that more liberal part that I mentioned to release, which is a mandate, is called mandatory parole, says the prisoner basically shall be released unless the prisoner has seriously and frequently violated the prison rules. Despite the critical importance of that language, seriously and frequently has violated prison rules, at no time has the Parole Commission issued regulations or rules that prisoners can be informed about, their lawyers might be informed about, regarding what that means to frequently violate a rule. What exactly is the Parole Commission's interpretation of that word? Or seriously violate the rule? What exactly is the Parole Commission's interpretation of those critically important terms? Now, for example, let's take Veronzo Bowers' case. Veronzo Bowers, I think he's been in prison something about 35 years. Veronzo Bowers has exactly one rule violation. That rule violation took place shortly after he was convicted and incarcerated about 35 years ago. That rule violation involved his attempted escape from prison. When Veronzo Bowers attempted to escape from prison, he did not have a weapon. He did not assault or attack anybody, any prison guard or anybody else. However, guards fired shots at him while he was attempting to escape.
Okay.
The Parole Commission takes the position that he is ineligible for release on parole under the, quote, more liberal approach, the mandatory approach, because he has a serious rule violation, which was his attempted escape more than about 35 years ago.
Yeah, and we are running short of time here, Peter Shea, but it seems to me as though, these 450 prisoners who are left perhaps eligible for the case you are making here, a lot of them are really elderly right now. And I mean, what possible threat are they saying, there could be to society? So the whole issue of not only these 450 prisoners, but for the prisoners who are elderly, many of them ill and infirmed, being still held in prison, really, is frankly highly questionable, to say the least. And who knows if it's even legal under international law? Maybe it is. But just a quick final thought from you on all this, Peter Shea.
Yeah, no, absolutely. If you take the case, for example, of Mutulu Shakur, he has pretty much for his entire over 30 years in prison has renounced violence, has called for the establishment of a Truth and Reconciliation Commission to address racial disparity in this country. The deputy prison warden at the prison where he is detained here in California has written a very clear letter saying, I'm an expert in rehabilitation. We're the people who have dealt most closely with Mutulu Shakur for years and years and years, and we believe he is rehabilitated and will not commit any further crimes if he is released from prison. And despite that evaluation by the folks who are really in the best position to evaluate whether he would ever reoffend if released from prison. Despite that position, the Parole Commission has denied him release from prison because 30 years ago he had a positive urine drug test.
Right. Well, we're going to have to leave it there. This has to be continued. We really are a little over time for this particular segment. So, Peter Shea, we, of course, will have you back. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much, Margaret. Happy to come back anytime.
All righty. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. We're going to take a short break. And coming up, why are mainstream Democrats so nervous about Bernie Sanders and even the Donald taking issue with Bernie Sanders? Waiting to join us in the wings, Norman Solomon and Diane May. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
This is Brother Cornell West, and you are listening to Sojourner Truth with host, my dear sister, Margaret Prescott.
When I was young, me and my mama had beef, 17 years old, kicked out on the streets. Though back at the time, I never thought I'd see a face. Ain't a woman alive that could take my mama's place. Suspended from school, I'm scared to go home. I was a fool with the big boys breaking all the rules. Shed tears with my baby sister. Over the years, we was poor than other little kids.
The late, great Tupac Shakur, one of my favorites, with his Dear Mama song. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. You're a member of Facebook. You can like and friend us on Facebook. Our handle on Twitter and Instagram at So True Radio. We're also on SoundCloud. Today, we want to give a shout out to our SoundCloud listeners in Atlanta, Georgia. And internationally, we want to give a shout out to our SoundCloud listeners in the First Black Republic, the island nation of Haiti. We are now going to just take a quick minute for our weekly Earth Minute. And then it's all Bernie. What's going on?
Despite mounting opposition to genetically engineered trees, researchers are preparing to request the USDA permit the release of a genetically engineered American chestnut tree for planting throughout the wild forests of the eastern U.S. with no oversight or regulation. Now, two board members of the American Chestnut Foundation have resigned to protest the organization's support for these trees. In their letter, Dennis and Lois Melikan stated, "We made the decision to join the American Chestnut Foundation 16 years ago, and we were prepared to volunteer until we were too elderly to contribute. Looking back, if we had known that Monsanto and ArborGen had an interest in and were funding the GMO chestnut, we would not have gotten involved. We are unwilling to lift a finger, donate a nickel, or spend 1 minute of our time assisting the development of GE trees or using the American chestnut to promote biotechnology in forests. In these days of ecological destruction and false techno-fixes, we need more people like the Melikans willing to take a stand for the Earth." For the Earth Minute and the Sojourner Truth Show, this is Ann Peterman from Global Justice Ecology Project.
All righty. And now for the rest of the hour, we're going to be focusing on what's going on with Bernie. He took the nation by storm on Monday, April 15th, in a much talked about Fox News town hall where he made his case for his 2020 campaign. Now, of course, it was controversial being on Fox at all, but Bernie's town hall event was the most watched town hall event of the 2020 campaign thus far, this according to Nielsen data. Also, Bernie is ahead of all of the others in the Democratic Party field in terms of fundraising. Of course, Joe Biden has not yet officially entered the race, but Bernie is also, for the first time in some polls, showing ahead of Biden, who is seen as a safe, you know, kind of centrist Democratic candidate. But let's go to some of the what Bernie had to say, the exchange that happened with Bernie Sanders at that Fox television town hall.
He came within a hair of the 2016 Democratic nomination.
This time, Senator Bernie Sanders says he's going all the way.
What's going to be different this time?
We're going to win.
With the party moving left, the independent Democratic Socialist from Vermont reminds voters he's the original.
3 years ago, during our 2016 campaign, we were told that our ideas were radical and they were extreme.
And in the shadow of this once iconic steel plant,
Senator Bernie Sanders talks the economy, jobs, and his vision for the future of America.
Hey, President Trump, my wife and I just released 10 years. Please do the same. Democratic socialism, to me, is creating a government and an economy and a society which works for all rather than just the top 1%. It means ending the absurd inequalities that exist today. And I want to lay this out because you're not going to hear this much on Fox and you're not going to hear this much in the media in general. And the American people have got to conclude whether we think it is appropriate and what America is about to have three families owning more wealth than the bottom half of the American society, 160 million people, whether it's appropriate for the top 1% to own more wealth than the bottom 92%, whether it is right that 49% of all new income goes to the top 1%, when many people, Brett and Martha, who are watching this program, are working two or three jobs just to pay the bills. So first of all, we want to create a government that works for all of us, and we want to create a political system which is based on one person, one vote, not billionaires buying elections as a result of this disastrous Citizens United Supreme Court decision. And furthermore, when I talk, and you know, people have different views of capitalism or democratic socialism, whatever it may be, but this is my view. I believe that human beings, especially in a wealthy, democratic, civilized society like our own, are entitled to certain basic rights. So let me be very clear, and I'm sure we'll discuss it later in the show, Brett. I believe that healthcare is a human right, not a privilege. Okay? And I believe that there is something embarrassingly wrong when the United States of America is the only major country on earth not to guarantee health care to all people. I live 50 miles from the Canadian border.
We're going to get in detail about Medicare. All
right. So health care is right. I believe that education, whether you're poor, whether you're rich, you have the right to get all of the education you need. And that is why I believe we should make public colleges and universities tuition free.
All righty. So there you go. Some of Bernie's message. I wish we could hear a bit more. A lot more was said on that town hall. I really think it's worth watching. But I'd like now to welcome our guests. First, I'd like to welcome Diane May. She is the communications director of Our Revolution, a leading nonprofit advocating for issues like Medicare for all and tuition free public college. Diane May, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Margaret.
I'd also like to welcome Norman Solomon, journalist, media critic, author, and activist. His dozen books include War Made Easy, How Presidents and Pundits Keep Spinning Us to Death. In 2016, Norman Solomon was elected as a Bernie Sanders delegate to the Democratic National Convention, where he was the coordinator of the Independent Bernie Delegates Network. He is a co-founder and national coordinator of the online organization RootsAction.org, which now has 1.2 million active supporters in the United States. Norman, welcome.
Thank you, Margaret.
Norman, we'll start with you. What are the centrist Democrats so afraid of here?
Well, they're afraid of a strong progressive populist candidate and a campaign behind him that could triumph and get him into the White House. Losing control of the Democratic Party is frightening and enraging to the corporate Democrats who have had such a hold on the National Party. And we are moving into a phase, a historic phase, of a huge battle between grassroots progressives giving an average of $20, $25 a donation to the Sanders campaign, and the Wall Street-backed corporate Democrats who do not want to lose their hold on the National Party.
Yeah, and Diana May, first tell us a bit, because I know it's confusing to some, the relationship between Our Revolution and Bernie and Bernie's campaign, because Our Revolution came out of Bernie's campaign. Tell us that and the role Our Revolution is playing now that Bernie has declared again.
That's right. Our Revolution was founded out of the Bernie Sanders campaign. We like to say he was our inspiration. And so since 2016, when we were founded, we have taken the lead in organizing the movement that grew out of the campaign to continue to, you know, organize and advocate for the issues that Bernie Sanders talked about during the campaign. So, you know, Medicare for all, free college tuition, increasing the federal minimum wage, and so many other issues, and also supporting progressive candidates who were inspired by Bernie's campaign and wanted to run for office in their own communities as well.
Right, and you've had some success and some losses, though, in that field, Diana May.
Yeah, well, we're really proud of our successes. We endorsed Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, we endorsed Rashida Tlaib, we've endorsed candidates for governor, we've endorsed Randall Woodfin in Birmingham, Alabama. So we're really proud to see our candidates winning, not just in blue states or quote-unquote blue districts, but also in the South and in red states as well.
So are you all able to actively be involved in supporting Bernie, or are you basically have to stick with some of the issues like Medicare for All that Bernie has put forward? Diana?
We're definitely involved in supporting Senator Sanders' run. While legally we can't coordinate with the campaign, we are helping our over 600 local groups all across the country and in 9 other countries to organize for Bernie in their own communities, whether that looks like, you know, tabling at public events or, you know, calling their friends and neighbors and getting them to support Bernie. We absolutely are involved in making sure that Senator Bernie Sanders is our next Democratic presidential nominee.
Yeah, and Norman Solomon, I wanted to play that clip of Bernie defining what a democratic socialist is, because it's clear that what Trump and his supporters are going to do is to just bash socialism. He's calling Bernie crazy Bernie, and socialist being a nasty word here in these United States. That is not true, looking around the world, and indeed most of the world. So recently also the Center for American Progress got into some controversy because of criticism. Some saw them as criticizing Bernie in a letter that was obtained by the New York Times. So there's some fierce infighting, it seems to me anyway, on the outside going on within the Democratic Party. Norman Solomon.
Well, on the first point, Bernie, as he did on Fox the other day, has doubled down and quadrupled down on advocating for democratic socialism. And CNN had a town hall with him a few weeks ago where he was asked about, well, you're a socialist, and he immediately replied, democratic socialist, lowercase d. He is emphatic that we have to ensure human rights for all, which include economic rights. And of course, he has an overall very class-oriented approach to how we get out of this rampant inequality and oppression that so many people suffer in so many ways. The Center for American Progress has a budget of $60 million a year. It's run by Neera Tanden, who has been very close with and worked as part of Hillary Clinton campaigns. And so what we're looking at is a really massive struggle between the forces that want to basically tinker at the edges with a corporate system which is inherently undemocratic, and what the Bernie Sanders campaign and grassroots activism for progressive causes, what all that really represents. And I think that Bernie Sanders as an individual, as a candidate, and the movements that are more and more coalescing as part of their work behind his presidential campaign are engaged in education and agitation. And you can hear it even in that just brief clip. from Bernie, where he is trying to massively scramble the deck that corporate media have provided, get away from these stereotypes, really educate about what is amiss here, not scapegoating those who are oppressed like the right wing does, but go after those at the top of the economic ladder who are manipulating the so-called democratic system. And while educating, he's also agitating. And we're all engaged in organizing, and that is really a great hope for the future.
Yes, and you know, back to you, Diane, of the what we're seeing is that 12% of people who voted for Bernie in the 2016 race wound up voting for Trump in the general election. This was during the primary period, right? And this is data from the Cooperative Congressional Election Study. And that those voters were reflected in states like Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania, which the Democrats lost last time. So the issue now is, can Bernie win those states back? And with the work you all are doing with Our Revolution, is there a focus on the states that the Democrats lost? I mean, those Rust Belt states like Michigan, Wisconsin, and further north, Pennsylvania. Diane.
Well, I absolutely think that Bernie can win those areas back. You know, there's hundreds of counties across the country, many of them in the Midwest, who voted for President Obama twice and then voted for President Trump in the general election in 2016. And what that says is that, you know, in 2016, the candidate that we had wasn't talking about the issues that mattered most to them. You know, President Trump was able to really talk in a populist way that appealed to people, you know, in Lordstown, Ohio, for example, where Bernie just was, who really wanted to hear a candidate that was going to fight for them. But I think that we saw this weekend in Lordstown when Bernie went that people are really ready. They've seen that Trump has essentially lied to them, and they're looking at candidates to see who's really talking about their issues, who's really going to fight back. And I think a lot of those people are pretty disillusioned with President Trump.
Yeah, and Norm. Right. Norman Solomon, back to you for a moment. I mean, in so many ways, an elephant in the room, from where I sit anyway, is the issue of race. Because, you know, here on Sojourner Truth, we've been talking about Donald Trump as being the global white supremacist in chief and bringing out the worst instincts of people and prejudices of people within the United States, but also lending power to rise of right-wing forces we see in certainly in some countries in Europe, with very few exceptions. And in the last presidential race, I mean, every sector of white people, non-college educated, college educated women, they all voted for Trump. And one has to wonder how much that racism or racist animosity had to do with that. And a lot of people say, well, that doesn't make sense because some of those people voted for Obama. So therefore, that eliminated race as a consideration. But a lot of us are not so convinced. And I really wish Bernie wouldn't use phrases like civilized society, which he did on Fox News, because a lot of us of color generally know what that means in terms of the global South. And also on the issue of reparations, a lot of people feel, well, he's a little bit shaky in contrast with some of the other candidates like Elizabeth Warren and Kamala Harris, for example. Any thoughts on this, Norman?
Yes, thank you. Well, you know, Bernie was confronted early on 4 years ago by Black Lives Matter, and later on Hillary Clinton and some others were as well. And I think Bernie was unique in that he actually responded and changed, both in terms of his staffing, which is now a majority of the top people of color, and also he changed in terms of what he had to say and what issues and how he was addressing issues. Stanley Greenberg, the pollster for the Democratic Party, said explicitly a year ago that contrary to mass media, the party doesn't have a, quote, white working class problem. It has a working class problem, and that's reflected in the turn down, the reduction in turnout among people of color in the general election in 2016, which then tipped the balance to Donald Trump. So I think that this is all a learning curve for Bernie, but we should remember he was arrested and involved in civil rights demonstrations back in college in Chicago a long time ago. Reparations is an intricate issue. Frankly, the right wing and the corporates love to bring it up because it's a way, they think, to drive a wedge between Bernie and people of color. And I think what he is saying, among other things, I certainly never attempt to speak for him, but my interpretation is that what Bernie is saying is that there are people disproportionately, people of color disproportionately affected by the inequality and the unjust social order in this country. Those people who are disproportionately affected are people of color, and we've got to go to the problem. And we need a commitment to ameliorate, whether it's police violence, the prison industrial complex, economic inequality, lack of access to college and health care. We've got to go directly to that problem. And I think what he's been saying is, when he's asked, which for media is sort of a gotcha question, do you support reparations? He's saying, let's talk about what we mean by reparations. When you drill down, other candidates are supporting a bill to set up a committee, an inquiry, to determine just what we do mean by reparations. So I think we're going to get clarity on this issue as the months move forward.
Right, and hopefully we'll see a bit more clarity from Bernie as well. I mean, we saw a university, I think it was George Washington, maybe, where their student body voted to increase their student fees by, I think, about $27 a semester, and that money would then go into a general fund to benefit the counties where descendants of people who were sold by that university enslaved. So there are a lot of things, practical things, likely that can be worked out. But no doubt, Bernie's shaking things up. And just a quick final, Norman Solomon, I don't know if you want to quickly weigh in on this, Diane May, but it does seem to me as though the Trump and the GOP going after Ilhan Omar and AOC, as she is now known, really is also about going after Bernie, frankly speaking. I mean, it's going after them also. I'm not saying it's the only thing, but what do you think, Norman? You think that's true?
Well, I think it is true. And Ilhan Omar and Rashida Tlaib subjected to tremendous bigotry against Muslims and racist bigotry, has had the quickest and most affirmative, vehement support privately and publicly from Bernie Sanders of all the people.
Yeah.
In the Senate, and I think that just speaks to where we need to be headed.
Right, and Diane May, we're out of time, but we also see tremendous support among young people for Bernie. So mainstream Democrats, better watch out. We want to, Norman, we have you back because this is the first as we're going to be doing our Sojourner Truth early presidential watch here. So I appreciate you taking the time, Norman Solomon, Diane May, to join us. Thank you.
Thank you, Margaret.
Okay, we're out of time. Today's show produced by me. That's Margaret Prescott. I'd like to thank our Sojourner Truth team, our audio engineer, Mr. T. Teddy Robinson, assistant producer, Romero Funes. If you'd like a copy of today's show, contact the Pacifica Radio Archives at 1-800-735-0230. Thank you for listening. This is your host, Margaret Prescott.